Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Managing Editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we've got a number of experts in the clinical care of MS who are in attendance at the 2022 ECTRIMS Congress in Amsterdam, the Netherlands. They join the show to discuss the themes and major presentations from this year's ECTRIMS Congress, as well as the lingering needs and advances that have been made in MS care, among other topics. So without further ado, let's dive in. One of the hottest topics of discussion at this year's ECTRIMS Congress were findings presented by Dr. Darren Okuda showing, for the first time, that disease-modifying treatment in patients with radiologically isolated syndrome can have a benefit. The findings from the ARISE study ultimately showed that early treatment with dimethyl fumarate, also known as Tecfidera, significantly reduced the risk of first clinical demyelinating event in individuals by week 96. Here's Dr. Okuda with his thoughts.
So I actually think we should start here, right? Because this is the first set of data that reveal that treatment in people with RIS actually is meaningful, and it actually can help to prevent the onset of a first clinical symptom. And that is absolutely massive. In our trial, we observed only acute clinical events, and we did not see things that were insidious or non-acute that evolved to a primary progressive disease course. But the meaning here is that there are individuals that perhaps could benefit from early treatment even before their first attack. And that's what's most remarkable. We've been involved in this research now for more than 6 years. And it has been a Sisyphean challenge with a square stone at times, is how I describe it. But it's the first data of its kind. This is a very important study because it is a US-only based trial. We would love to see studies worldwide. We would love to see more diverse groups, more diverse races and ethnicities included. We're excited at the opportunities of where we go from here with the knowledge that we've gained from our clinical trial, how to design the next set of wonderful studies that can actually help people before they're permanently disabled. I think that's really going to transform clinical care. I think it'll transform clinical surveillance. I think that such approaches will allow for us to really rethink about when we introduce therapy. And I think there are current concerns that are very valid. One is we want to ensure that we're characterizing people appropriately, because there are many people with non-specific changes in their brain that get labeled as having RIS when in fact it may not be. And the second involves the concerns regarding the expense to the healthcare system, to the consumer, etc. And with these therapies being very expensive, you know, there is a cost that makes some feel uncomfortable. Now, that may change with the advent introduction of more generic treatments and companies that aim to offer directly to customers without having to go through a third-party administrator. So, but these are exciting times, and I think overall these data also allow us to rethink. Should we start to think about how we diagnose people with MS and really start to introduce the concept and push it stronger? Of course, putting up additional safeguards to ensure that we're not over-recognizing, over-diagnosing people, but it's the right thing to do in medicine. You know, we can't take away a relapse. We can't fix disability as well as we would love to. And so it is all a play on primary prevention right now. And this work really supports that mindset. you'll find that the curve will be pushed further to the left. And is treating RIS too late? Has the biology already started? Absolutely. Why? Because the MRI scans are no different than those with clinical MS. And so, is it too late even to treat subjects with RIS? You know, our answer as a consortium is yes. But we need to take incremental steps in order for us to get to a point where perhaps we could even diagnose MS before first MRI scan is performed. And then perhaps to recommend the right interventions to allow for the prevention or to allow for a lower risk of evolving to MS at some point in time in a person's life based on who they are, how the environment shapes them, what their genetics are like, etc.
In MS, a major topic of concern for physicians has been the treatment of a similarly major symptom of the disease, fatigue. Manifesting in a number of ways, fatigue can be extraordinarily difficult to address clinically, and as such, much effort has been poured into researching methods to address it. But for experts like Federica Picariello, the key to addressing fatigue can be found in a better understanding of its driving mechanisms and the factors that influence it. Here's Dr. Picariello with more on how to address this symptom.
Obviously, mechanisms of fatigue are key in terms of treating fatigue better, but we tend to ignore not only the kind of the overall structure of fatigue. So our research, I'm a psychologist, so I focus on transdiagnostic factors. So be it cognitive, emotional, behavioral factors that perpetuate fatigue over time. So in our group, we draw a distinction, a very helpful distinction in relation to, you know, factors that precipitate the onset of fatigue, so triggers, which of course in MS or any other long-term condition are going to be pathophysiological in nature. But then you have perpetuators, so these are factors that are modifiable in treatment without pharmacological drugs. So this is what we focus on. What tends to unfortunately not happen in trials is that we're not looking at the model holistically. So we tend to not really study the pathophysiology of fatigue in enough detail, but also when we are evaluating trials of non-pharmacological interventions, so be it behavioral interventions or exercise, physiological outcomes are actually rarely included, yet it would be so interesting to look at the kind of whole pathway of how fatigue is, the onset of fatigue, how it's precipitated and also how it's maintained. And when we target the perpetrators of fatigue, what happens? Does that actually also change some of the physiological outcomes? So that's part of an important part of the work and something that is overlooked. The other thing is, and I think that's going to be very relevant to clinicians and kind of the service of the people who work in services with MS patients, is the fact that we often do not consider the mechanisms in practice, so in services. We often focus on individuals. Our patients are obviously our, you know, end goal user. We want the intervention to be acceptable to them. But equally, we need to consider how the intervention is going to work in routine care, how healthcare professionals are going to interact with it, how they're going to screen for fatigue, how they're going to offer different types of interventions according to needs. And this is something that we tend to overlook. So there is this kind of the model of fatigue that we need to understand better, but then also this model sits in the system. And this is something that we are not really quite doing right at the moment. There are almost two kind of sides to the question. So in terms of getting people motivated to engage in exercise, and I don't like the word exercise. I think it's all about physical activity and whatever that may be for an individual. I like running on a treadmill. I don't think many people do that or like that. Someone else might prefer dance. So it has to be, you have to really tap into what the individual wants. But in terms of motivation for this kind of, obviously pharmacological treatments, in the sense they're easier, in the sense that you're just, you know, popping a pill. But we don't have a magical cure for fatigue, unfortunately. And it does require much more effort when it comes to, you know, providing, offering non-pharmacological interventions, more effort from the perspective of the patient. So what we need to do is we need to always consider what is the end goal for that individual. What do they want to achieve? It's not about reducing fatigue or engaging exercise. What do they want to do? What do they want to be able to do if they're less tired? And I think that's always kind of in terms of clinical work and what we, when we provide therapy to people with long-term conditions who experience fatigue, that's always kind of the main aspect is, what do you want to achieve? What would your life look like if you were not experiencing fatigue to this extent? In terms of, sorry, what was the other part of the question? In terms of kind of actually improving management of fatigue more globally, I think it's about working together. I think that's what's missing. Psychologists, occupational therapists, physiotherapists, we kind of work on one side, neurologists work on the other side. We don't communicate enough, and I think what needs to happen in practice is almost like a clear treatment pathway, clear recommendations. And the first and foremost thing is actually measuring fatigue and routine care, because at the moment where that's not actually happening in practice. So some neurologists will ask about fatigue and other symptoms, but some won't. So we're not getting a picture of who needs treatment. And according to who needs treatment, we need to have some questions in place to understand what treatment is most suitable for them. And again, that requires both research, but also actually service development. And then having almost like a tree diagram of this person is experiencing fatigue. These are the factors that contribute to their fatigue. Therefore, these are the most appropriate treatments. And then you need to find out and have a conversation with that individual what would work best for them.
The opening lecture of the 2022 ECTRIMS Congress was delivered by Dr. Brenda Banwell on the topic of pediatric onset MS. Only recently recognized as a distinct condition, pediatric onset MS, despite its similarities to adult onset disease, produces some unique challenges by nature of the population it affects. These challenges are influenced by the difference between adults and children and can include those related to clinical care, trials, and research projects. Here's Dr. Banwell with a little bit more.
Well, I chose to highlight the journey that we've all been on over the last 20 years in terms of pediatric onset MS. So first thing I want to highlight is that MS does occur in children, which was not actually fully understood 20 years ago. Second, that MS is an age span disease. So children have relapsing remitting MS, and it is biologically, genetically, phenotypically, at least in terms of the typical type of relapses, generally very, very similar to adult onset MS, if not exactly the same. Pediatric onset MS occurs, however, in the context of a child, and so there is a particularly negative effect on cognitive development and academics, which one would expect. The brain is still developing, children haven't acquired all of their academic building blocks yet, and so having an inflammatory disease in the brain during that window of development has an effect, and we are hoping that higher effective therapies will reduce that negative effect. But it is a very real part of pediatric onset MS. The next thing that we highlighted as a community of people studying pediatric onset MS is that we can measure the effect of pediatric MS, at least quantitatively, on the brain and brain volume. And what we show is that even as soon as you measure it, first attack, the brain volume is already below what it should be for boys and girls of the same age, which suggests that that disease process didn't just begin when we met the child having their first event. It started way before that. How far before, we can of course not know. But Dr. McCanny and others have shown, in fact, that radiographically isolated syndrome, or the finding on a brain MRI, features that look like multiple sclerosis in someone who has perhaps had an MRI because they have headache, actually happens in children too. So early onset MS, and even the prodrome or the preclinical phase of MS, is a real component of pediatric disease as well. I think the next thing that is important to know is that the brain volume in children with MS is not only low when the disease starts, but the brain doesn't grow normally in children, so they don't reach their age-expected maximal brain volume. And then in teenage years, the brain volume starts to go down. So that, together with all of the impact on cognition, really motivates us to think hard about how we should treat children with MS. And just like in almost every pediatric situation, clinical trials for children fall way behind clinical trials in adults. They start much later, they're harder to complete, thankfully because pediatric MS is rare, but that still means that children living with MS do not gain access to highly effective new therapies at the same point as adults do. It takes years and years longer. Given that pediatric MS is a highly inflammatory disease with high relapse rates and a lot of T2 lesion burden, the imperative to get these highly effective therapies to our patients is extremely high and urgent. So we the community, have completed a variety of clinical trials, the PARADIGMS trial perhaps being illustrative of some key points. First of all, it was a large, double-blind, double-dummy clinical trial, which is not easy to do. It involved multiple sites in multiple countries, took a lot longer to complete than originally planned, in part because there's a learning curve with how to engage pediatric onset MS families in clinical trials. But the results were clear. Fingolimod was superior to interferon beta-1A on all measures. The patients treated with fingolimod had far fewer relapses and far fewer days of hospitalization, which is a pivotal metric when you're a child and you're supposed to be in school. And of course, there was also a favorable effect on MRI. So fewer new lesions, and there was a significant reduction in the rate of brain volume loss in children treated with fingolimod compared to interferon 1A. So those are really important. Those are the measures that we know correlate with poor outcome and that we worry about being predictive of long-term outcome. So it was promising to see that the drug worked on the early measures and provided some promise that it might mitigate the longer-term effects, and the extension phase is ongoing. So I think those are really, that was an important learning process. And then finally, moving into the next stage, there are multiple trials that are completing or just completed of other agents and more on the way. So my hope for the field is that 5 years from now, we'll be talking about a long list of treatment choices. And our next challenge will then be to predict or identify which choice is the best fit for a given child, just like it is in adults. So we've got lots still to do. Even though we've done a lot in 20 years, there's a great deal more that we need to do.
Much has been learned in the past decade about the care of women with MS, particularly those who are planning to become or are pregnant, as well as those patients during the postpartum period. Similar research has been done into NMOSD, or neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, that has provided information to clinicians about how to best manage these patients. At ACTRIMS this year, Dr. Riley Beauvais offered an overview of data on this very topic and spoke with us about the takeaways for the clinical community when it comes to managing these individuals. Here's Dr. Beauvais.
I think there are a couple of key takeaways for managing patients with NMO. The first is that they are at an elevated risk of relapses, certainly in the postpartum period, and possibly also in the pregnancy planning and pregnancy phase, especially if they're taken off their medications. And so really careful planning around medication timing and conception timing, and then medication restart postpartum is really important for maintaining stability for these patients, because we know that every relapse can be quite devastating. I think another take-home point is when you look at the relapse rates during pregnancy and postpartum, use of immunosuppressive therapies does seem to reduce that risk. And so again, just supports the idea of active treatment. And then a third concept is that patients with NMOSD are a little different from patients with multiple sclerosis. We don't see the sort of white preponderance. We're seeing that this occurs in people of many different backgrounds, as does MS, but more so in NMOSD. We also know that these patients have a higher risk of having other autoimmune conditions, other medical problems that may sort of either complicate their pregnancies or complicate their presentation or treatment. And so we want to make sure that we're reducing the potential for race and ethnicity disparities that we know are common in management of patients during pregnancy in general, don't really come to play in too impactful of a way in the pregnancies of our patients with NMOSD, so that we can make sure that they all get the best pregnancy and NMOSD care that they can. I think coming into the pregnancy, it's really important that we don't have patients off therapy. And so if a patient's, say, on a B-cell depleting therapy, we want to make sure that at no point do their B-cells repopulate. And so we have to be sort of more on the dot in terms of checking their labs and making sure that they don't have windows where they're untreated. In the postpartum period, there are a lot of things that we don't know. Certainly still trying to disentangle NMOSD, anti-aquaporin 4 antibody that's positive or negativity that could affect these presentations. The MOG antibody is really coming to light in terms of how it's different from NMS and NMOSD. and sort of how that impacts sort of our historical pregnancy cohorts. Were we sort of missing some MOG patients in there? So really kind of disentangling these various conditions based on seropositivity and sort of clinical criteria so that we can really better understand the course of each of these conditions. So I think that's still an unknown. And finally, when it comes to NMOSD, we don't really have a good sense of what factors may be protective, except for the treatments. So it's really important that we don't have too big of a time window in the postpartum period as well where the patients are untreated. So we don't know that breastfeeding makes a difference. We don't know any of these other sort of potentially sort of, you know, informative risk factors. We don't know much of that yet for NMOSD. So I mentioned a little bit about women with NMOSD having, or patients with NMOSD having a higher risk of other comorbidities and problems. And I think we're still, you know, there are some signals that there may be higher risk of gestational hypertension, higher risk of preeclampsia, eclampsia, and sort of potentially more complications. The problem is we still need more data to really be able to sort of pinpoint exactly what that risk is and whether it's a true signal. But that said, it just points to the importance of counseling our patients that they could run into trouble and that we should really take any high blood pressure signal seriously, any, you know, swelling of the feet or new headaches seriously, because they could indicate other complications of gestation. So I think just really sort of actively counseling patients to really, let's, you know, really stay on track with the prenatal care, take all the monitoring really sort of seriously, and make sure that there's a really collaborative care here, that the neurologists are communicating with the gynecologists and other care team members so that we can really guide our patients safely through the process.
Another hot topic at ECTRIMS was one that's lingered in MS treatment conversations for quite some time: stem cell transplantation. Although not a new theme in MS circles, new data are still being published, including a late-breaking presentation from this meeting from Dr. Tomas Kalinchik. He spoke about the shift in conversation about stem cell transplantation in MS, specifically how the big questions have gone from, is this a viable treatment, to where does this fit in the treatment landscape? Here's Dr. Kalinchik with more on his data.
Stem cells are not a new topic to MS. This is a topic that has been around for a number of years, and actually probably this is about the time where we should be thinking about correcting the misnomer that the stem cells is. What we're really talking about is a chemotherapy with a salvage stem cell transplantation. This treatment has been used for the last 20 years, typically as a salvage therapy in someone who doesn't respond well to other treatments, typically patients with aggressive disease who experience a number of relapses or extensive radiological activity despite being on highly effective therapies, or in the olden days when there were no highly effective therapies as the only available step up from the platform first generation of therapies. Nowadays we're in a slightly different situation. We have a large selection of therapies at our disposal that we can offer to our patients, and we are also learning how to use these therapies more efficiently, accounting for not only patients' demographic features or clinical characteristics, but also for potentially some more sophisticated neuroimmunological features and biological features of these patients. As we are learning about these features, we still can't quite understand whether HSCT, which is the abbreviation for the stem cell therapy, is really superior in any regard to the most potent standard conventional disease-modifying therapies. And even it sounds trivial, it's really a gap in the knowledge before we can proceed to the next step, whether it is a treatment worth engaging with. And the reason why I'm also saying that is that HSCT is not a trivial therapy. We're talking about a significant chemotherapy with potential significant side effects. Fortunately, the mortality, treatment-related deaths, have significantly declined over the last few years, and as we have learned to use the treatments more safely. But still, number of people, large proportion, 50, 60% of people, experience some form of adverse events after stem cell therapy. So we're not taking this lightly. And before we advise to someone that they should consider this treatment. We want to make sure that what we're offering to them is going to outperform their current treatment or anything else that we are able to offer them. And in this, in the current day, we're talking about the top therapies such as natalizumab or ocrelizumab, rituximab or alemtuzumab or ofatumumab. So that's where we are. What we have learned through a small number of trials in the past was that it is possible that chemotherapy with the salvage HSCT may be superior to potent disease-modifying therapies. However, these trials were not designed to really answer the question of a choice vis-a-vis a specific highly potent treatment in a specific condition or form of MS, such as relapsing MS or progressive MS. This year, we, for the first time, have a view of the data that I'm suggesting that there is a difference. And in what difference, in what sense that difference, what direction the difference heads. We know that HSCT is substantially superior to fingolimod and marginally superior to natalizumab and suppressing relapse activity. We didn't find in a study that we presented at these extremes an evidence of difference in effect on relapses between ocrelizumab and HSCT. But I also say that with a disclaimer that this was a relatively smaller cohort, and we also have a relatively shorter follow-up for patients on ocrelizumab, so there is more research to come in this area. Probably the most striking feature that we observed was that in comparison to fingolimod and natalizumab, patients on HSCT experienced much more frequent instances of improvement of disability, particularly during the first year after receiving the treatment. Up to 30% of people improved in terms of their neurological function, which is quite remarkable when we consider that we're comparing HSCT to natalizumab, which is known to, from clinical trials, to improve disability in up to 25% of patients who were treated with this medication. I think that we are, in these days, using HSCT with caution and a high level of appreciation for potential associated risk. And what we have learned now is actually more precisely where HSCT fits in the treatment protocol. As I heard someone say it today, where 10 years ago we were asking a question, should HSCT be in the treatment protocol? Now we are asking, where does it fit in the treatment protocol? So I think that answers your question. Yes, I think it's now part of the armamentarium that we can use.
Not unlike stem cells, telemedicine is another matter that's been in the discussion in medicine for quite some time. However, these conversations have really ramped up since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, as many hands were forced to dive into its use in the early days of lockdown. Born out of this has been more research into the utility of telemedicine, but also of its limitations. Now that some time has passed, the field has begun to better grasp where it fits best into the care paradigm. At ECTRIMS this year, Dr. Marissa McGinley offered an overview of the use of telemedicine in neurology to address disparities, as well as its pros and its cons. Here's Dr. McGinley with her thoughts.
The main thing that when we think about teleneurology, we think about its potential to improve access to care. And so with that, the potential to maybe serve communities that have been historically underserved, and we see healthcare disparities. So I think that that is sort of the goal of it. But I think the question also, anytime you're changing sort of the care pattern, is also, well, what sort of new disparities might emerge? And, you know, it's not necessarily going to be a panacea for all groups of patients, and so we need to understand who maybe we are helping to reach with that type of care delivery method, but who is not engaging with that method. So I think that's what's really important. And then, you know, as you mentioned, with the pandemic, obviously the whole landscape of doing telehealth visits has changed dramatically, and so understanding sort of what telehealth utilization looked like before the pandemic and then what it's looking like now, which I think there's kind of different stages of that too. You know, we had that early phase where it was almost mandated for everyone, and so it's very possible that in our clinics, most of our patients have now done a telehealth visit, but really overly, you know, more of a longitudinal course, understanding how patients are continuing to gauge in their care. Because, yeah, we want to obviously be able to use telehealth as a tool to help with disparities, but we need to be cognizant of any emerging ones that can happen with, like, a digital technology. I think that it's hugely variable, and I really ultimately want to meet patients where they want to be met. And, you know, I think that's really important. And to me, it's kind of, even when you're having, like, a disease-modifying therapy conversation, it's really important to say, this needs to be a shared decision. You know, the best healthcare, the best treatment is the one that you want to engage in. So I think that I have individuals that would probably be happy to not see me in person ever again. you know, and then we're kind of working out, when do we actually need to bring you back in clinic? So that is definitely one scenario. Just because, you know, they have lives, they're working full time, they have family. You know, I mean, it's, you know, convenient to just check in and say, like, yeah, did you get your MRI, your labs, how are your symptoms doing? And then I have other individuals that say, I never want to do one of those visits again. Like, they really like the therapeutic touch. They like coming in, you know, like, they like the comprehensive, you know, multidisciplinary care with everything coordinated. They come to the center and they see, you know, everybody at once. And that's very much, there's a community there. There's a connection for individuals. So we have, I think, that spectrum. I think as a neurologist, I see utility in really all spaces, you know, and I think those visits are a little different. You know, we're used to doing in-clinic visits a certain way with a very pre-forma, you know, like, history. We have our wedded, like, neurologic exam, and then, like, and I think a telehealth visit is, it's not exactly the same. You know, it's the same with kind of when we're thinking about other digital outcome measures. We're not necessarily trying to recapitulate the same experience that you have in clinic. And so in the telehealth visits, you spend a lot of time just discussing with patients, like, their symptoms, their lives, they're in their homes or at their work, and so naturally you talk more about that, which I think is very meaningful, and you get different things out of the conversation about their function and how their lives are going. And so even when patients, you know, having, like, potential relapses, like, there's some value of, like, bringing someone in to kind of document exam changes, but at the same time, I think a lot of it is discussion. You know, our MS patients have a lot of fluctuation in their symptoms, so much of that is the patient telling us what's going on. And so I see, yeah, I think that definitely, like, little check-ins, just saying, how you doing, getting your meds okay, you know, do we have your MRI set up, like, those are great for telehealth. But I think I've used it pretty much in every scenario you can think of. And, you know, I find it really valuable. I like to engage with patients in that way. But I think that's also, as much as our patients have preferences, I think clinicians also have preferences of how they engage best with their patients. So there's definitely going to be varying scenarios. I think the really important question is sort of dosing of it, you know, for especially that patient that's like, do I ever have to come in again? You know, we're asking that same question too. So right now in my practice, I often see people every 6 months, which I think is pretty common, you know, if people are doing well. And so we do a 6-month telehealth visit, and then the next one is often in person with, like, an MRI, because we coordinate some other things. So it's kind of been a little bit of a flip-flop, but the question is, can we start to space that out and maybe go 2 years? And depending on where the patient is, right, if they're in the greater Cleveland area, for me, and coming in is not too much of a barrier, then okay, but what about our patients that are out of state? Can we really safely not see them for 2-3 years in person? And I think that's a question that we all have.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.